Welcome back, everyone, to another deep dive. Today, we're going to be going back to 1967.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. And we're going to be looking at a Supreme Court case called Pearson v. Ray.
Okay.
And this one really gets into some complex legal concepts. We're talking about judicial immunity, qualified immunity for police officers.
Okay.
And all of this is set against the backdrop of the Civil Rights Act of 1871.
Wow.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So this is going to be a fascinating one. And the facts of this case are really interesting. We're talking about a group of clergymen who were arrested during a prayer pilgrimage for using a segregated bus terminal waiting room in Jackson, Mississippi.
So this case really highlights, I think, the struggle that was happening during the civil rights movement. You had people peacefully trying to, you know, challenge these segregation laws. And then you have the authorities who are trying to enforce the laws that were on the books at the time.
Yeah, absolutely. So let's break this down a little bit. Tell me more about this prayer pilgrimage. Who were these clergymen and what exactly were they trying to accomplish?
Well, this was a group of clergymen, both black and white, who were part of the Episcopal Church.
Okay.
And they were traveling from New Orleans to Detroit.
Got it.
And their goal was to advocate for racial equality and integration.
Okay.
And they knew that by challenging these segregation laws in Jackson, Mississippi, that they were going to be arrested.
So this was a very deliberate act.
Yes. Very much a planned act of civil disobedience.
Okay.
They knew what they were getting into.
Interesting. So they were prepared to face the consequences of their actions.
Oh, absolutely. And, you know, the sources really emphasize how peaceful these clergymen were when they entered the white waiting room only section at the bus terminal.
Okay.
They did so very calmly. They did not create any kind of disturbance.
Right.
They were there to make a statement against the law itself.
Got it.
Not necessarily to provoke any kind of violence or anything like that.
But they were arrested anyway.
Yes. They were arrested under a Mississippi Code section that prohibited congregating in a public place in such a manner as to breach the peace. Basically, the police claimed they were trying to prevent a potential disturbance.
Okay. But if the clergymen were being peaceful, was that a legitimate reason to arrest them?
Well, that's where things get a little interesting.
Okay.
Because we have some sources saying that there wasn't even a crowd present when this took place.
Okay.
But we also have other sources, and these are mainly coming from, you know, law enforcement officials describing a large and potentially hostile group of bystanders that had gathered around the clergymen.
Mm-hmm.
So there's this real difference in accounts of what was happening at the scene.
And that's a really important difference because it kind of speaks to the justification for the arrest.
Right.
If there wasn't a real threat, then you have to wonder, you know, did the police really have a reason to step in?
Exactly.
So we have these conflicting accounts about what was actually happening at the bus terminal.
Yes.
And I'm guessing this is going to play a big role as the case moves forward.
Absolutely. The clergymen, they were convicted under this Mississippi Code, and they were, you know, potentially facing a pretty stiff penalty at the time. The maximum was 4 months in jail and a $200 fine.
Wow.
But here's the twist.
Okay.
This is just the beginning of the story.
There's more.
There's a lot more to this.
Okay. This is already pretty dramatic. What happened next?
Well, on appeal, one of the clergymen, Reverend Jones,
right.
He actually got his conviction reversed in a retrial.
Okay.
And then after Reverend Jones got his conviction reversed, all the charges against the other clergymen were dropped.
So they were ultimately vindicated?
Yes, they were.
Interesting. And it sounds like they didn't stop there.
They did not stop there.
What happened?
They actually decided to fight back.
Okay.
They filed a lawsuit under the Civil Rights Act of 1871.
Okay.
Specifically 42 USC section 1983.
Got it.
And they sued the arresting officers and get this, the presiding judge in the case.
Well, hold on. Suing the judge? That's pretty bold.
It's a bold move.
Yeah. So how did the courts handle that?
Well, that's where we get into this concept of judicial immunity.
Okay.
The Supreme Court actually ended up upholding this longstanding common law doctrine that gives judges what's called absolute immunity from lawsuits.
Okay.
So they basically said that the judge in this case could not be held liable for his actions during the trial.
So no matter what a judge does in the courtroom, they can't be sued for it.
Well, that's essentially what this doctrine is saying.
Doesn't that seem like a lot of power?
Well, the court's reasoning was that judges need to be able to make decisions without fear of being sued later on.
Okay.
So you can imagine if every ruling a judge made could lead to a lawsuit.
Yeah.
It could be very difficult for judges to remain impartial and to really focus on applying the law fairly.
That makes sense.
Yeah.
But I can see how that could also be problematic.
Uh-huh.
What if a judge makes a decision that is clearly wrong or even intentionally harmful?
Well, you're touching on a very important point here.
Okay.
The idea of absolute judicial immunity definitely had its critics.
Okay.
And one of the most vocal was Justice Douglas. He wrote a pretty powerful dissent in this case, where he argued that complete immunity, regardless of a judge's actions, could open the door to abuses of power.
Yeah.
He felt that Congress, when they enacted Section 1983 of the Civil Rights Act, intended to hold everyone accountable for violating someone's civil rights, and that included judges.
So it's this tricky balance, right?
Right.
We want judges to be independent.
Right.
But we also need to have a way to address potential wrongdoing.
Absolutely.
It seems like this case really highlights that tension.
It does. And, you know, Pearson v. Ray didn't just stop at judicial immunity.
Okay.
It also addressed this issue of qualified immunity for the police officers who were involved in the arrest.
How's that different?
So qualified immunity for law enforcement is a little different from the absolute immunity that judges have.
Okay.
It really comes down to whether the police acted in what's called good faith and with probable cause.
Okay.
Even if the law they were enforcing was later found to be unconstitutional.
So basically, if the officers honestly believed that they were doing the right thing at the time.
Right.
Based on the information they had, they might be protected from liability, even if it turns out the law itself was flawed.
That's basically it. In this particular case, the officers argued that they genuinely believed that their actions were necessary to prevent a breach of the peace.
Okay.
And so even if their understanding of the law was, you know, a little bit off, they maintained that they were acting in good faith.
So we've got these two different types of immunity at play here.
Right.
And I'm guessing this whole good faith and probable cause defense for the police officers is going to be a major point of contention as we go through this case.
Absolutely. The Supreme Court didn't just like rule on it outright.
Okay.
They actually decided to send the case back down to the lower courts for a new trial.
Hmm.
They basically said, we want the claims against these officers re-examined.
Why send it back? Were there concerns about how the initial trial was conducted?
Yeah, there were a few things that kind of raised some red flags for them.
Okay.
They, you know, they recognized this idea of qualified immunity for the officers.
Yeah.
But they also acknowledged that the facts surrounding the arrest were pretty murky.
Right.
And there were even hints that prejudice might have played a role in the original verdict.
So back to square one for the officers. I'm sure they weren't too thrilled about that.
I'm sure they weren't.
Now, I'm curious about the clergymen themselves.
Okay.
They knew they were very likely to be arrested going into this whole thing.
Right.
Does that somehow affect their case?
That was actually a point that was brought up during the case.
Okay.
Could the clergyman's expectation of being arrested be seen as them consenting to it?
That's a really interesting question.
Yeah.
It seems like that would be a pretty big loophole.
Yeah.
If just knowing you might get arrested means you've given up your right to challenge a law.
Right.
So if you thought a law was unjust, but you knew you might be arrested for challenging it, that would basically mean you couldn't really challenge it.
Right.
That doesn't seem right.
Yeah, the Supreme Court, they were pretty clear on this one. Okay.
They rejected that argument completely.
Okay.
They said individuals have the right to peacefully exercise their rights, even if they believe that doing so could lead to an unlawful arrest.
That makes sense. Because otherwise it would be almost impossible to challenge any law you thought was wrong.
Right.
If you had to be guaranteed you wouldn't be arrested for challenging a law, then what would be the point of trying to change anything?
Exactly.
This case really highlights the importance of allowing people to peacefully challenge laws they believe are unjust.
It does.
Even if they know there's a risk of being arrested.
Right.
And it really underscores this complex balance between individual rights and the authority of the legal system. Especially during a period of, you know, major social upheaval like the civil rights movement.
Absolutely.
This is definitely a case with a lot of layers to it.
It is.
We've got these conflicting accounts of what happened at the bus terminal.
Yeah.
We've got questions about the police officers' actions.
And this really fascinating back and forth about judicial immunity and its lingits.
Uh-huh.
I'm hooked. I can't wait to dive in a little bit deeper.
Me too.
And when we come back, we're going to dig into those conflicting accounts about the crowd at the bus station.
Yeah.
And really unpack what probable cause means in this context. So stay with us.
Sounds good.
Welcome back. So before the break, we were talking about the clergymen who were arrested during that prayer pilgrimage in Jackson, Mississippi.
Right.
and their lawsuit, which really challenged both judicial immunity and qualified immunity for police officers.
Uh-huh.
And one of the big questions that came up was, did the police actually have a legitimate reason to arrest these clergymen in the first place?
Yeah, that's a key question.
So let's dig into these conflicting accounts about what was happening at the bus terminal.
Okay. So these conflicting accounts are really at the heart of the case. Because remember, the officers are trying to use that good faith and probable cause defense. They're saying, hey, we genuinely believed that a breach of the peace was about to happen, and that justified our actions.
Okay.
Even if our understanding of the law was a little bit off.
So their whole defense hinges on whether they had a good reason to believe that things were about to get out of control at the bus station.
Exactly.
But, as we discussed earlier, there are very different versions of what was actually going on.
Yeah.
You know, got the clergyman testifying that there wasn't this, you know, threatening crowd. They were simply trying to make a peaceful statement.
Right.
But then you have the police saying, no. There was this large, potentially hostile crowd gathering, and we were really worried that the situation was going to escalate.
Exactly. And that's a big difference.
It is a huge difference. And if there wasn't this real threat of violence, then the whole probable cause argument kind of falls apart, doesn't it?
It does. Without a genuine threat, it becomes much harder for the police to justify their actions.
Even if they say they were acting in good faith based on what they believed at the time.
Yeah.
And that's why the Supreme Court decided to send the case back for a new trial, right? Yeah. They wanted the facts surrounding the arrest to be more thoroughly examined.
Yeah, they wanted to make sure that there wasn't any bias or irrelevant information mm-hmm. that might have influenced the jury in that first trial.
You mentioned bias. Was there something about that first trial that seemed unfair?
Well, the Court of Appeals, they actually pointed out that there were these kind of irrelevant and prejudicial questions that were brought up during the cross-examination of the clergymen.
Yeah.
Apparently, the defense attorney was trying to, like, dig into the clergyman's views on racial justice.
Mm.
And they even tried to connect them to the Communist Party.
Wow. So they were really trying to paint them as, you know, these dangerous radicals or subversives.
Yeah, it's a classic red herring tactic, right?
Right.
You try to distract from the real issue by bringing up something that's totally unrelated.
But what does their political affiliation have to do with whether or not their civil rights were violated during the arrest?
Exactly. It's a distraction. It's a way to try to shift the jury's attention away from the facts of the case.
Right.
And the Supreme Court, they recognized this.
Yeah.
They wanted to make sure that the new trial focused solely on what happened during the arrest, not on these extraneous political affiliations or anything like that.
It's a good reminder that everyone deserves a fair trial.
They do.
Regardless of their beliefs or their background.
Absolutely.
You know, due process is essential, especially when we're talking about fundamental rights,
mm-hmm.
like freedom of speech,
mm-hmm.
freedom of assembly,
right.
the right to challenge laws that you think are unjust. Okay, so the Supreme Court sends the case back down to the lower courts
right.
for this new trial, focusing on the police officers and their actions.
Oh.
But what about the other big issue in this case? Judicial immunity.
Right. So that part of the ruling stood.
Okay.
The Supreme Court upheld the idea of absolute judicial immunity.
Okay.
Which basically means the judge couldn't be held liable for what he did during the trial. They really felt like that this protection was essential to make sure we have an independent judiciary.
Right. But as we discussed earlier, you know, Justice Douglas had some pretty strong words about that in his dissent.
Yeah.
He seemed to be really concerned that if judges are completely shielded from any consequences for their actions, even if they make decisions that are, you know, blatantly wrong or that violate someone's constitutional rights,
right.
that could create a real problem.
Yeah, he made some compelling points. He argued that the whole intent of the Civil Rights Act of 1871
uh-huh.
was to hold everyone accountable for violating civil rights.
Right.
And he said that should include judges.
Yeah.
You know, granting judges this absolute immunity, in his view, went against the spirit of the law.
So this whole debate about how to balance judicial independence with accountability is still something we grapple with today, isn't it?
It is.
You know, we want judges to be free to make decisions without being afraid of, you know, repercussions.
Right.
But we also need to have some safeguards to make sure that they're not abusing their power.
Absolutely. It's a very complex issue.
It is a complex issue. Yeah. And, you know, the court in Pearson, they ultimately sided with this need for judicial independence.
It did.
But I think those dissenting opinions serve as a really important reminder.
Yeah.
That even these long-held legal doctrines need to be you know, scrutinized and debated,
yeah.
especially when there's a risk of shielding individuals from accountability for potential wrongdoing.
Right. Now, let's shift gears a little bit and talk about the impact this case had on the legal landscape.
Okay. So we've talked about, you know, the specific details of the Pearson case,
mm-hmm.
the arrest, the lawsuit,
mm-hmm.
the arguments about probable cause and judicial immunity.
Right.
But I'm curious about the bigger picture.
Mm.
How did this case shape our understanding of qualified immunity for police officers?
Well, that's a great question. Pearson v. Ray is often cited as kind of a landmark decision.
Okay.
Because it really solidified this concept of qualified immunity as we know it today.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it really kind of set up this balance between protecting law enforcement officers who are acting in good faith
right.
and holding them accountable when they actually violate someone's constitutional rights.
And finding that balance, I imagine, is the key, but also where things get really complicated.
It's one of the most challenging aspects of this whole debate.
You know, it must be so tough to define what good faith really means.
Right.
And to figure out when an officer's actions were reasonable or not.
Uh-huh. Especially in those situations that are, you know, very chaotic.
Yeah.
Everything's happening very quickly.
Exactly.
It's tough to make those judgments in the heat of the moment.
Right. The court in Pearson did give some guidance, though, right?
They did. They basically said that officers shouldn't be held liable if they genuinely believe their actions were lawful.
Okay.
Even if it turns out later that the law they were enforcing was unconstitutional.
So it's not enough to just show that the law was later declared unconstitutional.
Right.
You would have to prove that the officer acted in a way that was objectively unreasonable at the time of the arrest.
Exactly.
Given what they knew about the law back then.
Right. But, you know, critics of qualified immunity, they argue that this standard gives way too much leeway to law enforcement and makes mm-hmm. it really difficult to hold officers accountable, even when there's evidence of excessive force or bias.
Yeah.
You know, they say that it creates the system where police officers are rarely held responsible for their actions, yeah. even when those actions cause harm.
And I imagine supporters of qualified immunity would say, look, this is necessary to protect officers from frivolous lawsuits.
Right.
And to allow them to do their jobs effectively without constantly second-guessing themselves in these really tense situations.
That's exactly their argument. They say without this protection, officers might hesitate to act decisively, you know, which could put public safety at risk.
So it's this classic debate.
Yeah.
You know, the need for law and order versus the protection of individual rights.
Absolutely.
And it's a debate that continues to this day.
It does.
And Pearson v. Ray really captures that struggle perfectly.
It does.
It's not just this fascinating historical case. It raises these timeless questions about the role of law enforcement
mm-hmm.
in a free society.
Right.
And how we can make sure that justice is served.
Absolutely.
We've unpacked a lot, but there's still so much to explore.
There is.
So after the break, we're going to dive into the clergyman's prayer pilgrimage itself.
Okay.
We'll talk about the broader context of the civil rights movement.
Sounds good.
And we'll reflect on the lasting legacy of Pearson v. Ray and think about what lessons we can draw from this case today.
Yeah.
So don't go anywhere. And we're back. We've been spending this deep dive talking about Pearson v. Ray,
yeah.
this Supreme Court case that dealt with judicial immunity, qualified immunity for police, and, you know, really civil disobedience during the civil rights movement.
Right.
Before the break, you mentioned the clergyman's prayer pilgrimage.
Yes.
What can you tell me about that? And how does it fit into this bigger picture of what was happening in America at the time?
This was not just some random group of clergymen deciding to test the waters of segregation. This was a very deliberate and organized effort to fight for racial equality.
Right.
You know, think about the freedom rides.
Right.
Think about the lunch counter sit-ins.
Yeah.
The marches.
Right.
These were all very deliberate acts of civil disobedience that were designed to challenge these unjust laws and push for social change.
Yeah, it took incredible courage to participate in those demonstrations.
Absolutely.
You know, they knew that they were risking arrest, violence, even imprisonment.
For sure. And the clergymen in Pearson were no different.
Right.
They understood the risks. They were prepared to face the consequences.
Yeah.
And their willingness to put themselves on the line for the cause of justice is really remarkable.
Absolutely. It speaks to how deeply they believed in what they were doing.
Yes.
You know, they were convinced that challenging these segregation laws was worth the risk, no matter the personal cost.
Right.
And, you know, their case, in turn, really highlights the legal battles that were intertwined with this movement for social change.
It does. It reminds us that the law can be a very powerful tool for both good and bad.
Right.
You know, it can be used to protect rights and uphold justice, but it can also be used to perpetuate injustice.
Yeah.
And it's often during those clashes, those moments when the law is at odds with morality,
right,
that we see the most profound legal and social transformations.
That makes me wonder, you know, what would have happened if those clergymen hadn't filed their lawsuit? What if they had just accepted their convictions and moved on? Would things be different today?
That's a great question. It's impossible to say for sure, of course.
Right.
But it's very likely that the development of qualified immunity as we know it now would have taken a different path.
Okay.
Pearson v. Ray was such a pivotal case in shaping this legal doctrine.
Yeah.
And its influence is still felt today.
So as we wrap up our deep dive into Pearson v. Ray, what are the key takeaways?
Okay.
What should our listeners really remember about this case?
Well, first, I think this case really solidified that idea of absolute judicial immunity, shielding judges from being held personally liable for their actions taken in their official role.
Right.
You know, it's based on this notion that judges need to be able to make decisions without fear of being sued,
right,
which helps to ensure an independent judiciary.
But as Justice Douglas pointed out, we can't just give judges a blank check.
Yeah.
You know, there needs to be some way to hold them accountable.
Yes.
If they abuse their power or deliberately violate someone's constitutional rights.
Absolutely. And the second major takeaway, I think, is the establishment of qualified immunity for police officers.
Okay.
You know, offering them protection from liability as long as they were acting in good faith and had probable cause for their actions.
And we've talked about how, you know, this concept of qualified immunity is still hotly debated today.
Yeah.
Some people feel like it gives law enforcement too much leeway.
Right.
Others maintain that it's essential for officers to be able to do their jobs effectively.
Yeah.
The case also really reinforces the right of individuals to peacefully challenge laws they believe are unjust.
Yes.
Even if they know they might be arrested for doing so.
Right. The court in Pearson made it very clear that, you know, anticipating an arrest does not equal consent to that arrest.
Right. And that's crucial for protecting our freedom of speech and our right to protest.
Absolutely.
And finally, I think Pearson v. Ray serves as this, you know, stark reminder of this tension that exists between upholding the law and protecting civil rights.
It does.
A tension that was really at the heart of the civil rights movement.
Yes.
And one that we continue to grapple with today.
Absolutely. It's a fascinating case study.
It is.
That shows how the law can be both a force for progress and a barrier to justice.
Yeah.
You know, it raises these important questions about the limits of immunity, the importance of a fair trial,
right,
and that ongoing struggle to balance individual rights with societal order.
Well, Pearson v. Ray definitely gives us a lot to think about.
Yeah.
It's a case with, you know, historical significance, legal complexity, and continued relevance to our lives today. We've explored the facts, the arguments, the context.
Yeah.
But now I want to leave our listeners with one final thought.
Okay.
Does this concept of absolute judicial immunity as it stands now strike the right balance between the need for an independent judiciary and the right to seek justice when our constitutional rights are violated?
That is a question with no easy answers.
It's not.
And it's one that legal scholars and everyday citizens alike continue to wrestle with.
Yeah.
As our legal system continues to evolve, it's a debate that will likely continue for generations to come.
Well, thank you so much for taking this deep dive with us. We'll be back soon with more fascinating legal cases and complex issues.